Yeah, can we? I was wondering if this title should, the title of this episode should just be "Spoiler Alert: Robots."
Oh my god, I was thinking something similar earlier on too.
I think that would be right on. Spoiler Alert: Robots. We give away half of the shows and movies you haven't seen.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there is in fact going to be a lot of robots in this episode. So it is kind of a spoiler alert.
In case you haven't seen many of the pop culture movies about robots in the last, say, 35, 40 years, you may want to go catch up on The Terminator, Bicentennial Man, The Matrix,
Ex Machina, Her, Blade Runner 2049, and also Blade Runner 1.
And of course, Transformers.
We don't totally recommend that one. But, you know. Anyways, welcome, as always, to This Anthro Life. I am Adam Gamwell.
And I'm Ryan Collins.
And we are very excited to be back with you today in 2019. This is our first episode coming at you. Today we're talking with longtime This Anthro Life collaborator Emma Bakke. She is a scholar. She's doing her PhD at GW in Washington, D.C. She does a lot of awesome research in South Africa, looking at cyber violence against women. She also runs The Geek Anthropologist and is a resident expert on all things comics, AI, sci-fi, and more.
In today's discussion of robotics, we dive into issues of automation, care, what is the difference between AI and robots, and how do those inform each other? We also have the cultural traditions about robotics, and that gets us into much more deep and philosophical narratives of consciousness, and what is it to be human, and how do we define what it is that's human versus robot, and vice versa.
Just to give you a, you know, we kind of actually hit record a little bit late in the conversation. So we're about to jump into it where Ryan asked a very important question to Emma and I. Ryan, what was that question?
What is a robot?
Get ready.
Isn't that just what Transformers is?
Yeah, I think you're right.
That sounds accurate. Yeah. Wait, so the question is, but could there, like, maybe a robot would be if, like, Bumblebee goes to college.
Oh yeah.
And like Optimus Prime takes him and drops his office, like, remember, son, being a, what's the good guy's called?
Transformers. Autobot.
Autobot. Remember, son, being an Autobot is all about treating Decepticons with dignity.
Right.
And standing up for your family. And also keg. What if there was a Transformer that was a keg? That'd be a robot, I think.
I feel like that's probably some like deep, deep alternative porn somewhere.
Well, there is that fake movie trailer for 50 Shades of Bumblebee.
That sounds amazing.
Oh, it's pretty great. Check it out.
It would probably be a lot more consensual than the original 50 Shades.
I think so.
That's true. One of the questions that I think is really interesting about this topic is the uncanny valley, right? When, you know, this phenomenon, when, you know, obviously video games are a good example of this. Like, you know, in the 80s and 90s, you know, I remember as a kid being like, wow, Super Mario Brothers looks amazing. And then like when GoldenEye came out for N64 in 1997 or something, also thinking how awesome those 3D graphics were. And then of course today, you know, we have Red Dead Redemption 2 or something on Xbox or PS4. And it's like these hyper-realistic graphics, right? And like, we haven't yet entered the uncanny valley, but there are times if I've been playing Red Dead Redemption that you realize how real it looks, you know, particularly if you turn on the cinematic camera. So this question of uncanny valley is interesting when we apply it to robots, you know, because C-3PO, the famous gold robot from the original Star Wars trilogy, you know, doesn't cross this valley, right? Because he doesn't look too much like a human, but it's his gender. He's called a he. You know, he has a name that everybody uses. He has a personality, and he's shaped, you know, he's very much a humanoid robot, you know, but it doesn't cross that really weird threshold of you're not totally sure if it's real or not. You know, if he's not human, you know, we know he's not, but
right.
A lot of things we're seeing today in lands of robots, depending on like, this is one of these questions of anthropomorphizing them. They can kind of seem eerily human-like, but they're not quite there. There's something dead about them almost.
Yeah, I think that speaking about video games and crossing the uncanny valley, there was an issue with that game Mass Effect Andromeda that came out a couple of years ago, right? And I think the initial backlash illustrates a good meeting point where the uncanny valley seemed to have been breached and something was frightening about the characters. because initially the faces of the characters, despite being, you know, really modern graphics and looking great, were programmed by an AI to respond to characters. Ooh. So their mouths would look like puppets and their eyes would move like wooden blocks. Ah. So it was incredibly creepy and frightening to the point where people complained, and all of the faces were hand-drawn by artists to have more human-like gestures.
Interesting. So AI only goes so far in terms of creating what it thinks a human would look like and act like.
At least currently.
For now, right? Exactly. And that's the question. Are we heading in this direction of making, you know, robots... And of course, you know, because we're talking about computer graphics in this case with video games, but you're right, if we're having AI artists create them. And these are some of the perhaps more public renderings that we see of, mm-hmm. you know, fictional beings that look like humans brought out there. But then when you bring it to these physical beings like robots, I don't know, it really is an interesting question. I mean, Emma, do you have, you know, does the Uncanny Valley, what do you think about that when you say robots and Uncanny Valley? Are there certain robots that come to your mind or certain like characteristics that you feel like embody that idea?
Yeah, I think one thing that I was thinking about through all of this is also the purpose that the robot is put to and the way that then inflects how we think about the Uncanny Valley. So this idea that there was the sense of horror that emerged from the characters in Mass Effect make me think a lot also about the Uncanny Valley of dolls, especially, and mm-hmm. the way that oftentimes dolls can actually be turned into robots. So I'm thinking about one of the original androids that was actually created in the early 1600s as a sort of doll with internal clockwork to it. But thinking a little bit about, you know, we have so many different categories of robots. So a lot of what we've been talking about is sort of what's in the media. But then we also know that we have robots that are serving caregiving roles. We have sex robots. So even thinking about how the level of expected emotional intimacy that we're supposed to have a robot and how that then impacts what strikes us as being sort of strange or ominous.
That's a really interesting point. I think the question of purpose is you're right on, because a lot of times when people, you know, might bring in the conversation of robots, there's kind of, you know, I don't know how wide robot conversations are in public, but it generally seems like at least in the news media, right, the most common narrative is about automation and job taking. But then when you kind of get into it further, there is these questions, I think you're totally right, of care and emotional, you know, giving or support, and then like sort of into and related to the notion of sex and intimacy. And I think that's really quite, you know, interesting to think about, again, what narratives circulate where. But I actually want to think about this question of the purpose of robots. You know, this got me thinking, because we're talking about the question of what conversation around, you know, anthropomorphizing robots tell us perhaps about being human or about making robots. And one of the things that I came across, this occurred to me, was this notion of, like this is really the psychology of attachment and loss. And this is, you know, we'll see how much it may or may not be related, but this idea, like, so Harry Harlow did this interesting experiment called the monkey love experiments in the 1950s. And, this popped into my brain when I was reading about, you know, how people, learn to trust quote unquote robots. And in these experiments, what he found, he's doing these with rhesus monkeys. So sort of a distant cousin of Homo sapiens, of a new world, you know, correlate. And he found out by removing babies from their mothers, which is messed up anyway, he would make a terry cloth mother that like more resembled the physicality of the mother. And he also made then a wire mesh monkey that had a bottle. And what they found in these experiments was that almost unilaterally, the baby monkeys would go to the terry cloth mother, even though it didn't have sustenance, rather than spending time on the wire quote mother, you know, that had milk. And so, you know, they concluded in these studies that, you know, attachment in this case was not, you know, it's like the idea of like learning what you attach to is not primarily based on, I need to get sustenance or feed, you know, there's something else emotional that matters about that. So it's not just about serving a, you know, strict, you know, biological, I need to eat, otherwise I die, you know, need. And that's quite interesting to think about. And then on top of that, like they did a second, arguably more messed up experiment that we can say, you know, 60 years later, of course, 70 years later now. That, you know, when they would separate the baby monkeys, and then when they would raise some of them with the terry cloth mother and some of them with the wire mother, and that they found out that the baby monkeys that were raised with the cloth mother were developmentally more mature and that they could handle emotions more than the ones with wires, particularly when there was something scary, like there's a loud noise or a teddy bear. You know, the baby rhesus monkeys that had the cloth mother would go cling to the cloth mother, and the ones that only had the wire mother would like throw themselves on the floor and scream in terror and kind of rock themselves back and forth. Like things like gestures that we immediately recognize, right, as signs of terror. And there's something really compelling about, you know, the idea that we can see how attachment and loss happens based on, you know, when and what we feel an emotional attachment to, you know, and how what that has to do with our development. So I think that, like, to me, that really, I hadn't expected to make this connection, but I think there's something about the notion of attachment, right? And then why we choose to anthropomorphize robots, you know, and then why we see them kind of stepping into or reprogramming them into these spaces of care and of intimacy.
I think it, you know, for me, it also raises interesting questions about, I think to your point, like why, what is the purpose of robots and what are the different spaces that they occupy? I'm almost wondering, you know, when we talk about the notion of robots, you know, we're also probably coming in with very different ideas of what our cultural touchstones are for a robot, especially because if you look at media, there's sort of the robots that are supposed to serve as the kind of productive role. They're either doing the menial labor and jobs that, quote unquote, humans would not want to necessarily fulfill. And then there's also that level of emotional intimacy. And I'm wondering, because the concept of robots is so broad and vast, and they occupy very different spaces, I'm wondering for us, like, what are, when we think of robot, are there examples that we think of? So we had mentioned C-3PO, and then we had also mentioned Mass Effect. I know for me, the first thing that I think about is the robot from Metropolis, who then is sort of wrapped up in this idea of sort of production and a critique of capitalism, but also ideas of sort of modern femininity, domesticity, passivity. And I'm wondering if it'd be useful to think about the different robots that come to our minds and also the purpose that they're supposed to serve, either in real life or in terms of driving a narrative.
That's a really compelling question. I mean, one that came to my mind is I don't remember her name, but the robot from Ex Machina, which is a really great sci-fi film, right? And that was, you know, it almost seemed kind of like a update on the question of Metropolis, where it was this like very sultry female robot that was supposedly designed around a Turing test, right? That was testing whether the human could tell they were interacting with a computer or not. And, you know, it's an interesting sci-fi film anyway, in terms of like, really how autonomous are robots, because you don't totally know in that film, which is pretty cool. But again, right. But it was this like, you know, coded female robot. And then you learn in the film, hope not giving too many spoiler alerts, but like the robot was specifically designed by the creator to arouse emotional intimacy and sexual desires of the person that was taking the Turing test. Domhnall Gleeson was the actor there. And Alicia Vikander was the robot. And it was really, you know, that to me struck me, because it was this, you know, it was both an interesting story of like what happens when we fail the Turing test and, you know, could a robot go on a rampage? But then further, that really like was a film that to me made me and I think viewers meditate on this question of like, you know, what happens when these robots are like designed to look like they're about care and intimacy and sexuality, but they're really not. You know, in this case, this is for testing, doing a Turing test. But then on top of that, like, you know, robots go a little robot-y, I guess, and kill people. But I don't know. That's half-formed thought there.
I think there's something to that, too. And this whole conversation is making me think about, like, shamefully, the Terminator, right? The whole Terminator series, or at least the first three or four. I don't know where they're at right now. But again, like, for anybody who hasn't seen the Terminator, you know, spoilers, right?
Dude, I haven't seen it yet.
You have this hyper-masculinized, vengeful robot from the future that's coming to hunt down Sarah Connor and then John Connor to ensure that a very dark history takes place, where robots are, they've taken over the world and humans are either their slaves or their batteries, or maybe I'm thinking of The Matrix, maybe I'm playing
also, also that.
Either way, it's something like that. It's not a good outlook. But at the end of the, with the second film, you see the Terminator again, But this time, Arnold Schwarzenegger is the friendly robot who's going to save them from the other robots. Mm-hmm. And then with, I think, the third or the... the third movie, there's a much older Arnold Schwarzenegger robot that comes back in time that's meant to interact with the male character from the second movie, who's now an adult. Mm-hmm. And he's there looking the way he does because he's like, I was supposed to elicit an emotional response to you.
Right. And yeah, that's a good point too, right? That is part of that narrative.
Right. So I think there's a lot of complicated things there with hypermasculinity, with an emotional response, and an idea of care, but then an idea of an erasure and fear of that care too. It's complicated. Mm-hmm. More complicated than I think it was supposed to be.
Well, and I think it sort of illustrates, going back to this idea of the uncanny valley, this tension of both affection and fear that I think has often historically pervaded the way that we treat robots. I feel like the question of robotics more often than not sort of leads to this broader philosophical question of like, what does it mean to be human? Do we ultimately have free will? If we are programming something in a very particular kind of way, does it make it any more or less real than the way that humans operate? And I think that tension between sort of the mixture of both care and potentially love of robots in these situations, but then also this fear that the thing that we are able to create will ultimately be our downfall, creates this really interesting emotional admixture that also informs the uncanny valley.
Right. And this is making me think about two different ideas that are being put forth with this notion of automation and how robots and AIs are going to end up having a much larger prominence in social experience in the future than they do now. And this documentary that came out on HBO in 2018, late in 2018, called, I believe it's The Truth About Killer Robots. And it focuses on this issue of that tension between affect and fear, right? In the way that you were explaining it now. And one of the most affect-driven moments is this discussion of whether or not it would be beneficial to have robots as caregivers for the elderly, knowing that there are going to be more elderly people than young people around to take care of them. And then how do you create a sort of ecosystem where that care can be given? But then at the same time, there's also the fear of, will automation drive away the sort of careers that people might otherwise have?
Yeah. I'm kind of curious too, and Emma, because you're more of a resident expert on sci-fi kind of novels and writing. I'm kind of curious, like, are there examples you can think of in books or comics or whatever you've read, mangas and stuff? I guess, I don't know, I'm trying to think about in terms of other like fears elicited in narratives like this about robots taking jobs. Because it seems like a lot of time you look at any sci-fi or pick up Andromeda and it's like, nobody's freaking out that robots took a bunch of jobs, you know? Mm-hmm. And like, why is that? Like, why does the narrative kind of seem, maybe because I also am saying I might have a limited perspective of what I've read, but like, doesn't it seem that like there's a jump there where it's like that? Because I think you're totally right, Ryan, that is a legit fear today. Mm-hmm. But it like doesn't seem to be so big in sci-fi.
Potentially. Now I'm thinking more about the overall Mass Effect series and AI there, because initially the initial series is sort of overshadowed by the dark villain that is supposed to be the AI that went out of control. The robots want to destroy everything. So therefore, organic life has to be wiped out.
Okay, yeah.
And so they're sort of pitted as the big bad at the end of it.
But then, so that is taking a lot of jobs, such
right.
as life.
They take all the jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that it's important, AI and robots can sometimes coexist, but it depends in terms of if you want to also create a typology of the difference between like robots, AI, cyborgs, for instance. But I think jumping off of Ryan's point and Adam, your question as well, I think more often than not, robots are seen as it goes far beyond jobs to the question of sort of supplanting humans. So I think we see a lot of narratives where oftentimes robots are sort of supposed to be the sort of stand-in of slaves or indentured servitude. And in some way that absolves sort of the ethics of it because they don't have a soul, right? They're not human and therefore it's less potentially morally fraught to employ robots in that way. But then the moment where they are able to achieve consciousness, where that artificial intelligence sort of flips the switch, or what Ray Kurzweil has described as the singularity, in which there is sort of that consciousness, which you see, as we've said, in Terminator or in The Matrix. You also see a similar kind of narrative happening in the movie iRobot, which is obviously an adaptation of Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy, where there is either a consciousness that arises in which robots then sort of become the new version of what it means to be human in terms of what we think about as consciousness, in which case it becomes an issue of survival far beyond jobs. Or that our flaw as creators of these robots is that we wrote the code wrong, or we didn't think about all the possible contingencies of what sort of a technological evolution would look like. And so, as you see in things like iRobot, where the sort of mandate to serve and protect and care then gets rewritten as sort of that reversal of imprisonment, where the robots then feel like they have to control humans.
Right. And I think that what you're kind of pointing out here is that we're using robots as sort of a social instantiation for almost everything that mythology before today has sort of represented. We see robots on the one hand as possible slaves. We see robots on the other hand as possible monsters. We see robots as being potential captors. We see robots as also being potential deities, but we also see robots as also being us, right? And there's that tension of, are they us, are they not us, and how do we equate that, right? And on the one hand, like as you're saying, is consciousness the thing that makes robots jump over that threshold and kind of be like us? So is consciousness the defining factor in what we're calling personhood today? So I guess this whole conversation is making us think that, or it's making me think that robots are sort of, or at least our framing and talking about robots is sort of a new take on thinking and reflecting on what it is to be human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. It makes me, you know, so obviously some examples that come to mind in this case from our nice canon or Westworld, right? The HBO show, but also the Michael Crichton movie that came out in the 70s before it. But this is like, that's, you know, one of the central questions of the two seasons that have been out so far is like, is consciousness A, the center of the maze, if you haven't watched the show. And then second, you know, is that what then defines, is that what makes the difference between us, you know, humans? And obviously, you know, you don't need, no spoiler alerts, but you know, the show, like one of the central robots, like it's on this quest, Dolores. And there is this like ongoing question of, has she attained consciousness, and has Maeve, played by Tandy Newton, also attained consciousness? We don't totally know in the show, right? But they're both taking slightly different approaches to what it means to like find that sense of I am, you know, which you're right, Ryan, like forever has been one of these, you know, hallmarks of what we think to be human is, right? This is one of the debates that the scientists have talked about between philosophers, between what makes a non-human animal and a human, what differentiates them, or plants in humans for this case. Yeah, I think it's and obviously, you know, Westworld tells its own cautionary tale, right? Of if they do, or they're trying to attain consciousness, robots in this case. And as we know in Westworld too, like they were, as you pointed out, Emma, like essentially they were slaves, they were sex slaves, they were objects of violence, you know, they were there for spectacle, the robots, for on a human playground, right? And so it's like, you know, consciousness, you know, raising or becoming conscious is wrapped up in this like recognition that one's been having violence done against them, right? And that they have been enslaved, that they are pawns, right? And so I think the idea of like finding consciousness too, in the robot narrative in this case, like is really compelling and troubling because it is wrapped up in this kind of violence, right? It's not like robots went on a quest to find themselves out in space and like discovered a new species and realized, wow, together we can be more, right? It's like, no, we're revolting because you've been abusing us. You created us for abuse, right? And that's pretty intense.
And I think it, to your point, gestures at the fact that so many of our narratives about robots are inherently violent. And I think that comes from this recognition that most of the way that we have treated and conceived of robots has been violent, whether sort of put to violent purposes or the, you know, if we think about applying some anthropological concepts like structural violence or symbolic violence, right? There is it is inherently a non-consensual situation. And so there seems to be this sort of tacit recognition that the purpose to which we are putting these robots is violent. And, you know, the running thread throughout Westworld is these violent needs have violent ends. I think I'm garbling that, but this idea that it will sort of come back to haunt us. So we are very much aware of the violence we are perpetrating, and that will ultimately be our undoing.
It isn't funny too, because then like built into that narrative is like, we can't help ourselves. The humans can't, right? And that's, you know, I don't know if that says about us, but like why that's part of our like really common human narrative, right? Is that like, we know we're doing bad and we know we're inflicting violence, but we like either don't care or don't stop ourselves until we are forced to stop. And that, you know, and robots are some of the few examples of sort of others in sci-fi that do that to us. Aliens, of course, are another good version of that. But like in this case, robots, because they're as I think importantly that often that we created, right?
Right.
Our creation comes back, and you're right, like come bites us in the ass or literally kills us.
Yeah. Although I am thinking about Bicentennial Man, which was a movie from the early 2000s with 1999 with Robin Williams, where Robin Williams basically plays a robot, and he is supposed to sort of be the caregiver, almost like a stand-in nanny and helper around the house. But as he starts to bond with his family realizes that like potentially there is sort of a person inside of him. And so the movie ends up being sort of a cogitation on what would it be like if we allowed these robots sort of the free rein to explore and to consider what a internal life would look like for them. But I feel like the peacefulness of that movie stands in stark contrast to the way that we often depict robots in our cultural media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder about that too, just in terms of reflecting on the violence behind robots that we tend to see and the sort of fantasy of that violence, right? Because at the current moment, I don't think we have any examples of Terminator-esque robots walking around that you go and shoot at some sort of robot shooting range or enacting out this type of stuff. I'm sure there are plans to build something like this, but
yeah, probably.
It makes you wonder about the sort of artificial reality of that. And is violence okay in the sense when it's artificial in the robot way, or when does that line become blurred, right? When does it become artificial versus real?
And even like I didn't actually see this movie, but it was the Hugh Jackman movie Real Steel, you know, where it's like the Rock'em Sock'em Robots robot film. But did either of you see that movie?
No.
I have not.
Okay. That'd be a good example then. But it seems to me that's like, you know, literally humans controlling a robot, and it's based on robot violence, but like that's like, you know, a remote control car. So it seems like, yeah, for some reason, like there's not that issue in that case, right? But that's one example, which is a really lame example. But
No, but it does make me think about going back to our initial conversation about Transformers, and then I'm thinking about one of my other favorite movies, which is Pacific Rim, where you have the kaiju, which are the Japanese monsters, versus the Jaeger, which are these giant robots, which are sort of in the tradition of also like Gundam, things like that, where the robots are the protectors. They're the ones that are sort of stepping into the breach where humans can't. Although it's a little different because in things like Voltron, which is a show on Netflix, and then Pacific Rim, you always have a human pilot on the inside of the robot. So then it also gets to this question of, you know, what it means to be a cyborg, because I think, as I said earlier, there's sort of this slippery line, because if humans are able to sort of mind meld with a robot to a certain extent to protect humans, it yet again returns us to this question of what does it mean to be human?
We hope you enjoyed the first part of this conversation. Be sure to check back soon as we dive into the second part of this conversation when things get a little bit more intimate. A special thanks to Emma Bakke for joining us today. And as always, I'm Ryan Collins.
And I'm Adam Gamwell.
We'll see you next time.